Today's lecture is presented by Dr. J. Edwin Orr, internationally known writer, lecturer, and Christian teacher. Dr. Orr has visited almost all of the countries of the world. His score of books of travel, history, theology, and biography have a circulation exceeding 1 million, apart from translations into 15 languages. He's an elected fellow of 6 learned societies, and one of his doctorates was earned at Oxford University. Dr. Orr has lectured in universities on all 6 continents, and we've asked him to share with you some of his arguments proving that faith makes sense. Many outstanding scholars and leaders of Christian thought have collaborated with Campus Crusade for Christ in the preparation of a series of recorded lectures presenting what Christians believe. This significant undertaking is designed to make the claims of Christ and the great doctrines of the Christian faith available to collegians of all lands. Today's lecture by Dr. Orr is entitled Chance and the Cosmos. It's my privilege to present Dr. Orr.
A pilot came to talk to me in my office in New Guinea, and he said, "Tell me, Chaplain, why is it that any man is compelled to hold a religious faith or have a philosophy? Is that absolutely necessary? Couldn't everything have happened by chance?" So I asked him jokingly what he knew about chance. He told me with a grin he was an expert. I took out a coin and tossed it, and I asked him if it were heads or tails. He replied, "Heads." "Now tell me," I said, "what is the chance of getting heads when you toss a coin?" He suggested 1 out of 2. When I asked him why that proportion, he replied that each coin possessed only 2 sides, heads and tails, therefore it had to be one or the other. "What," I asked, "is the chance of getting 2 heads in succession?" He replied, 1 out of 4. When I asked him for the chance of obtaining 3 heads in succession, he replied, 1 out of 6, and then corrected it to 1 out of 8, because it was a multiplied chance. "That's right," I agreed. "It's the probability of the first occasion, multiplied by the probability of the second occasion, multiplied by the probability of the third occasion." "What do you know about dice?" I asked him. He grinned, and I said, "Well, what's the chance of getting a 6 when you roll dice?" 1 out of 6, he said. "For 2 sixes in succession," he said, 1 out of 36. "For 3 sixes in succession, 1 out of 216. For 4 sixes in succession," he estimated quickly, 1,296. Then I asked him, "What was the chance of getting 12 sixes in succession?" He allowed me to supply him the answer. 1 out of 2,176,782,336. I asked him then, "What do you think is the chance of getting dice to roll the same way all the time?" "Why," he said, "that's fantastic." "Exactly," I said. "Yet you talk about chance to explain the origins of our complex universe." The conversation lapsed for a moment, then I had a chance to expand the argument. I said, "Let's take something a little bit more complicated. Take the human body. When your life began, it began as a single cell, which doubled after fertilization. Then it became 4 cells, 8, 16, 32, until it became thousands of cells, and finally millions of cells. But from the beginning, these cells seem to follow some kind of plan and pattern, each taking its proper place, each following much the same pattern of organization until finally you were born. They continue to cooperate in a complex organization. If I want to send a telegram from Los Angeles to New York, I go to a telegraph office, take a telegraph form, write out my message, take it to the clerk in attendance, pay a certain amount, and leave the telegram for dispatch. That message may be typed out, given to a telegraphist, sent by cable or radio to New York, where it may be decoded, and then delivered. Can you imagine that happening by chance? Can you imagine the underground cables being there by chance, or the telegraph poles, or the telephone instruments, or the telegraphists, or the pay clerks? Supposing I take a pin and stick it into your leg, a nerve in your leg sends a telegram to your brain saying, "Murphy, you've been stabbed." Then your brain sends a message to your vocal cords urging them to utter something appropriate to the occasion. Do you think that happened by chance? I told him of an incident that happened on the campus of the University of Washington. After one of our lectures, an atomic scientist came up to me and he said, "Orr, your illustration about the coin and the dice is very interesting, but it is quite superfluous. In physics, statistically speaking, there is no such a thing as chance. When one burns hydrogen in oxygen, the result is pure water. When one burns hydrogen and oxygen 100 times, one gets water 100 times. When one burns hydrogen and oxygen 1,000 times, the result 1,000 times is water. When hydrogen is burned in oxygen 1,000,000 times, the combustion will form pure water 1,000,000 times. "That I know," said the pilot. "I know also that mixing hydrochloric acid and caustic soda, two deadly but different poisons, produces common salt. But isn't there an element of chance in the behavior of radioactive atoms?" I was prepared for his question, so I said, "Well, I quoted, statistically speaking, there is no such a thing as chance in physics. It's true that no scientist can predict which of the atoms of a bit of uranium will break down, but he can predict their number, for that's exact enough. It's your privilege to believe that such things happen by chance. And it's your privilege to believe that the whole amazing universe originated by chance. But it doesn't make much sense to me. The Christian believes that the complex design of the universe is a result of the planning of a superintelligence. This is most reasonable. If you can show me that it's unreasonable, or that any other explanation is more reasonable, then I withdraw my argument. Chance is less reasonable. So the choice is yours to believe in God." My pilot friend was such a gambler that his own habits reminded him constantly of the arguments against chance. And this so unsettled him that he began to consider what he had heard so often, the reasonable claims of the Christian faith and the good news of salvation. On another occasion, on the island of Morotai, a pilot came to see me and he said, "Chaplain, I approve of the good work that you are doing, but I do not believe in it." He went on to explain, "Some of these GIs get scared and they need a bit of religion to help them. But I'm an atheist and I don't need any religion to help me at all. Could I ask you a couple of questions?" "Go ahead and shoot," he said cheerfully. "First, do you happen to know everything?" "No," he replied. "Professor Albert Einstein says that scientists as a whole are on the fringe of knowledge. So I'll be quite modest and admit that I'm on the fringe of the fringe." "Good," said I. "Now, the second question is this. Is it conceivable that God could exist outside all that you happen to know?" He hesitated a moment. "How much do you know?" I asked. He said, "How much do I know of what?" I said, "How much do you know in relation to total knowledge? 10%? 10%, he replied. "Less than 1%. "Well," said I, "let's say just 1%. Is it possible, then, that God could exist outside your 1% of knowledge?" "Well," he said, "yes, theoretically, yes." "You're a remarkable atheist, then. 5 minutes ago you said there was no God, and now you said it's possible there is one. Why don't you make up your mind?" My friend, the pilot, came to see me a week later. I felt sure he would. He served as a pilot of a pursuit plane, a single-seater, so he had plenty of time to think on the way back from missions. "Chaplain," he said, "I've been thinking a lot, flying back. You know, you're quite right. No man knows enough to describe himself as an atheist. I just used the wrong word. I'm not really an atheist. I'm an agnostic." "Congratulations," I said. "You like that?" said he. "Yes, that's fine. Last week you said you're an atheist, that God did not exist, but you couldn't prove it, so you're in a weak position. Now you say that you're an agnostic, you don't know whether there's a God or not. You're in a much stronger position because you're telling the truth. You just don't know. The word agnostic comes from the Greek word agnoskos, which means I do not know. For that word was first used by Thomas Huxley to describe one who was not bold enough to deny the existence of God, but who found himself unconvinced by the arguments for God. Then I asked him what kind of an agnostic he happened to be. "Are there different kinds of agnostics?" he queried. I answered him quickly, "Yes, there are two main kinds. Just as among Christians there are Roman Catholics and Protestants, so among agnostics there are two main denominations, the ordinary agnostics and the ornery ones." "What do you mean by that crack?" he said. "Well," said I, "the ordinary agnostic claims, I don't know whether there's a God or not. But the ornery one says, I don't know, you don't know, nobody knows, nobody ever will know. I asked you what kind of agnostic you happen to be, because if you say that you know that I don't know, I'm going to ask you how you know that I don't know." "Look here," said the pilot, "I quit right there. I'm a plain, ordinary agnostic." "But what do you say about arguments for ordinary agnosticism?" There aren't any, I said, just to provoke him. What, he retorted? Professor Julian Huxley is a brilliant scholar and he's an agnostic. I said, granted that Professor Julian Huxley is one of the most brilliant experts in his field, in biology, but how could any man be brilliant in agnosticism, which means not knowingness? Long ago in Chicago, I took some hermeneutics work. Do you know what hermeneutics is? No? Does Joe here know what hermeneutics is? No? Neither of you knows? Then which of the two of you is more brilliant in not knowing? You were good in physics and Joe in mathematics, so which is more brilliant in not knowing hermeneutics? So what? Professor Julian Huxley is a brilliant man in biology, and he says he's an agnostic, not knowing whether there's a God or not. So we consider that brilliant not knowingness? Imagine one of your professors telling you after examinations, you're obviously clever in things you know least about, but you're really brilliant in things you know nothing about. When a man says he doesn't know, he disqualifies himself. But listen, Chaplain, said the pilot, why is it that such brilliant men accept demonstrated evidence in other fields of knowledge and yet insist that they cannot know God? I replied quite frankly to that. They won't accept the only evidence. Supposing everyone in a class of students were blind, and a professor announced that he wanted to talk about vision. The students voted 26-1 not to accept eyesight as evidence. They thereby disqualified themselves. Some people say they refuse to accept any evidence whatsoever unless they can smell it, taste it, feel it, see it, hear it, or take its specific gravity or atomic weight. No kind of spiritual experience is accepted. I tell them, quite simply, let's suppose that there is a supreme intelligence. What scientific test would you suggest? Barometer? Geiger counter? Spectrograph? Those who insist on what is commonly considered scientific evidence must be used in all matters theological and spiritual are becoming ornery agnostics. Instead of humbly admitting that they lack an experience of God, they begin to deny that anyone else could have such an experience. Well, we meet all sorts of arguments, and I find that one of the greatest arguments against faith in God is the so-called scientific one. There was once a fellow in California who was completing his doctoral thesis on alcoholism. You know, what makes some folks get drunk. He found an eager rascal on Skid Row willing to do all the necessary research for him for nothing but the raw materials for the experiment. This zealous fellow got drunk on Mondays with whiskey and soda, on Tuesdays with rum and soda, on Wednesdays with gin and soda, on Thursdays with brandy and soda, and on Fridays with vodka and soda. He was quite a broad-minded man. The research expert asked himself, what is the common denominator? What gets him drunk? It is obviously the soda. Now, such scientific jargon sounds convincing, but it's sheer nonsense because the man was working on the wrong premises. People will accept a pseudo-scientific theory, providing it is couched in scientific language, with never a thought of examining the premises. When Winston Churchill stood in London and declared, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the streets, we shall never surrender," what chemical formula said that? That was the spirit of Winston Churchill. And what is the specific gravity of a spirit? Nobody can say. It's impossible to know God in any other way than by spiritual means, because God is a spirit, and spiritual truth is spiritually discerned. I once asked my professor of geology, "Is there anything in geology to hinder your believing in God?" He replied, "Certainly not. Geology is a study of the crust of the earth, and you wouldn't expect to find God among the sedimentary rocks." I asked a chemist the same sort of question, and he replied that chemistry is a study of the elements and their compounds, and one wouldn't expect to find God in a test tube. I think I could add that not one branch of science, from astronomy to zoology, contradicts the idea of God. One day, a student said to me, "Why is it that you religious people can't prove anything? A biologist can take you to his microscope and an astronomer to his telescope, but you religious people are always talking about taking things by faith." I replied to him, "Can't you see that true faith is a kind of eyesight? Just suppose this whole class were blind from birth, and I'd been asked by the professor in charge to deliver a lecture on the beauty of color. I begin by saying, gentlemen, color is a manifestation of light. Up goes a hand. Sir, before we go any further, what is light? So I reply, don't you know what light is? And the answer is no. Well, let me explain. Light is a kind of radiation. You know what heat is? Well, just as heat radiates warmth, light makes things visible. Another hand is raised. What is visible? I explain that visible means able to be seen, but this doesn't mean anything to anyone in the audience. I say, let me go on. If light from a window strikes a prism of glass, it breaks up into a spectrum of color on the wall, like a rainbow. Up goes another hand. Sir, what's a rainbow? I explain again, a rainbow is caused by the refraction of the sun's rays in a rain cloud. A rainbow is red and blue and green. Another hand is raised. Sir, what's the difference between red and blue and green? To which I reply, red's the color of blood, blue's the color of the sky, green's the color of grass. But not a blind student in that room has ever seen anything. Someone asked me, what's the essential characteristic of red? And the only reply I can give is, it's reddishness. Then a thinking student says, is it possible to describe color in scientific words without referring to the context of eyesight? I explain that a Swedish scientist named Angstrom measured the wavelength of color. Red is 7,000 angstrom units. Blue is 4,500 angstrom units. Do you think for a moment that all these blind-from-birth students would nod their heads in appreciation of this explanation in the exact language of science? Don't you agree that a poor old washerwoman with the blessing of eyesight knows more about color than a blind mathematician? Likewise, a poor old washerwoman with the perception of faith in God knows more about the why of the universe than the most brilliant unbeliever. I remember on another occasion, my tent mate, during the landing on Morotai, was an obstetrician. He was a fine sort of fellow, but each night we had to spend in a foxhole dodging the bombs. One midnight, this medical officer said to me, "Now listen, chaplain, God's nothing more than an idea in people's minds. If you were to talk to a Solomon Islander and ask him about God, he says the thunder is God. But go to India and talk to an Indian peasant. He can explain the thunder, but when an epidemic breaks out, he says the gods are angry and he rushes to burn incense in his temple. If you travel down to Australia, you find an educated Australian who can explain both thunder and epidemics, yet he uses the term God to cover up what he cannot understand. What I'm trying to say is this, that the farther you push back the frontiers of knowledge, the less you need an idea of God. God exists only in people's minds." "You mean," said I, "that if the whole human race were destroyed in a catastrophe, God would cease to exist?" "Well, let me take up the analogy you've given. Supposing you talk to a Solomon Islander and ask him, 'Have you ever heard of King George?' He replies, 'Yes, me British subject, me belong King George.' But you say, 'How do you know there is such a person as King George? Have you ever seen King George?' The simple Islander says, 'No, but me British subject, me belong King George.' Then you say, 'Well, what do you think King George is like?' Now that's a fair question. In the Solomon Islands, the chief of a village has four wives and the chief of an island has 40 wives. So the islander suggests that King George is a very big chief with 4,000 wives, which is a rather primitive idea of a constitutional monarchy. Travel from the Solomon Islands to India and ask an Indian peasant whether he has ever seen King George and what he is like. He thinks in terms of a local Raja or a neighboring Maharaja or one of the Mughal emperors. So he says King George is the British Raj, the Emperor of India. An Australian says, 'You Yanks don't understand monarchy. The king doesn't rule us, he reigns. He's the symbol of the Commonwealth. He doesn't tell us what to do. We rule ourselves just as much as you do. We're a free people.' Then if you go to London, you may meet someone who says he went to Cambridge University with King George when he was a young prince. You meet Princess Elizabeth, who talks of her royal father as Daddy. You talk to an American who tells you cheerfully, 'It's all right for the Limeys to have a king, but we don't need one in America, though we don't mind them having one.' Then you talk to a Russian who says the king is nothing more than the cat's paw of a capitalist system. and he says that the communists will destroy the monarchy in Britain just as they did in Russia. Now, there are seven different ideas of King George. But an important thing to remember is this. If there is such a person as King George, seven different ideas don't change his character. There may be 1,001 ideas of God, but if there is a God, these ideas do not change his character. Then said my friend, the doctor, how is anyone to know anything at all about God? I replied, Jesus Christ is a living photograph of God. He is God revealed to us in human form. And the more we think about that, we find that the revelation of God, as we find it in Jesus Christ, has never been surpassed. The world has many great religions, but you will not find a higher ideal, a higher concept of Almighty God in any other religion than what is found in Jesus Christ. What's the explanation for this? Very simple, that Jesus Christ is who he claims to be. He claimed to be God revealed to man. So as we consider these objections to the Christian faith, we should ask ourselves very simply, is my explanation of the universe more reasonable than that of the Christian faith? Is the Christian faith utterly unreasonable? And if a thinking man is willing to concede, no, it makes sense, then he must think for himself, what is my relationship to God? And what does Almighty God, who placed me here on this planet, expect me to do?
If this lecture has stimulated your thinking, may I invite you to discuss these most important matters with the one who's invited you to listen.